First of all, I would just like to say that I, for one, do not necessarily welcome our new market-manipulating robot overlords. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risdahl. It is Thursday today, the 29th day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. An interesting thing happened on the way to the closing bell today, and you're going to think I'm being facetious, but I'm actually dead serious. The thing that happened was that President Trump said something, and the markets reacted hard. Exactly what he said, that trade talks with China are going to pick back up, quote, at a different level, isn't really our point here. He says stuff like that all the time. What we're interested in is the market reaction, because the president says stuff like that all the time, sometimes without any substance behind it. So we've called Joe Gitz. He runs a company in Chicago. It's called Social Market Analytics that uses Twitter data to figure out which way the markets are going to go when the president and others say things like the president said today. Joe, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you, Kai. Thanks for having me.
So what do these algorithms do when they see, for instance, a tweet or a statement from the president today that says, as I mentioned, you know, talks with China are proceeding at a different level? And everybody was really happy on Wall Street, apparently.
Yeah, everybody was certainly happy today. So these algos are reading the president's tweet using natural language processing. And our current president's tweets are pretty easy to read with NLP. And they are either going long or going short.
So, going long or going short, buying or selling, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so we see all this happening almost in real time. The president tweets and the markets move up or down depending on what the news of the day is, or frankly, you know, whatever the Chinese say. Here's the question. Algorithms are software, basically. They are written by people. People see these reactions and they see the markets going bananas one way or the other. Clearly, the people who write these algorithms say, oh yeah, all that volatility is fine.
The algos want volatility. The algos make money because of volatility. And so if there's a self-fulfilling prophecy, these algos start buying or selling. There's going to be wave upon wave of buying and selling, and the retail is going to get in at the back end of it. So there's no incentives for the algos to dampen volatility at all.
Retail getting in on the back end is actual human beings and mom and pops and what have you, right? They're following the algorithms.
And they are so far behind.
So when we look at this craziness, we should just say, yeah, that's computers, and go on about our day.
It is computers, yes. And it's growing. If you go back 5 years ago when I started doing natural language processing and became a Twitter partner, there were very few firms that were taking this data and making trading decisions on it. Now, with the processing that can happen, more and more firms are using natural language processing, and it's very clear where the president's going to go first. You never have to worry about whether he's going to do it on the news, whether he's going to do it in writing. He's going to go to Twitter first, so you know if you follow Twitter in a programmatic manner, following the president of the United States, you're going to get a lead on most everyone else.
This president will either in a year and a half or 5.5 years not be president anymore. Then what happens?
I think there's been a fundamental shift in how people communicate. I don't view Twitter as a social media company. I view it as a news source. And I think that people are going to continue to use it.
I'm going to ask you to make a value judgment here then. Entirely apart from making money, are these algorithms and the outsized effect that they have on movement of the markets, are they a good thing or a bad thing?
I think they're a bad thing in general, because I think the volatility causes a lot of panic buying and selling, and I think the average investor gets hurt by it.
Joe Gitz is a CEO, also one of the co-founders of a company called Social Market Analytics. They're based in Chicago using Twitter data to figure out what's going on out there. Joe, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Kai, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It was fun.
It has kind of slid by in the crush of other news out there, but Sunday is September 1st. No, that is not the news. The news is that September 1st is when the president's next round of tariffs on Chinese imports kicks in. The list runs 122 pages from live purebred breeding horses at the top of page 1 to antiques of an age exceeding 100 years at the bottom of page 122. Obviously, we can't cover them all. The program's only half an hour. But we are going to sprinkle some tariff schedule knowledge and context throughout the program today, starting with Harmonized Tariff Schedule subheading 8481.90.50.
Parts of hand-operated and check appliances for pipes, boiler shells, tanks, vats, or the like, other than of copper or iron or steel. Ballasts for discharge lamps or tubes. Nickel-cadmium storage batteries. other than of a kind used as the primary source of power for electric vehicles, lithium-ion batteries.
The iPhone that I'm using right now has a lithium-ion battery in it.
That's Kelly Speaks Blackman. She's the CEO of the Energy Storage Association.
The imports from China of lithium-ion batteries are approximately 40%. China is the primary supplier of lithium-ion batteries.
Used in phones, yes, laptops and MP3 players, but also
the electric vehicle industry, which has really been growing in demand and a growing sector in our economy today, is a demand source for lithium-ion batteries.
15% extra for all those batteries come Sunday. More tariff love coming elsewhere in the program. Wall Street on this Thursday. Getting back to what Joe Gitt said, the algorithms loved what the president said about trade talks. Forget that Sunday tariff deadline. What? Me worry? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Trump administration announced today that it's going to loosen the rules on how much methane that oil and gas producers can put out into the atmosphere. Methane, which is a potent greenhouse gas, way more so than carbon dioxide, can leak in a whole lot of places in the production process before it gets to consumers. Andrew Wheeler, the head of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, offered as one reason for loosening the rules that methane is valuable and the industry has an incentive to minimize leaks and maximize its use. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore tests that proposition.
The EPA is basically asking, why would a company just let one of its products, one of the things that it sells, just whoosh out into the air? They've got to want to capture it, right?
They only have the incentive to do that if the cost of finding that methane and capturing it is less than the value of the methane.
Alan Krupnik is a senior fellow at Resources for the Future. It is sometimes more expensive to find leaks and fix them than the methane itself is even worth. In fact, sometimes companies can't sell the stuff at all. Tom Covert is assistant professor at the Booth School of Business.
There are parts of the country and times in the year when gas pipeline capacity is at the limit. And so the price that a firm selling natural gas into this pipeline network would get might sometimes be negative.
But however much a company wants to capture leaking methane or is incentivized to capture it, that is different from how important it is to society for companies to capture it. Katie Hausman is assistant professor at the University of Michigan.
The damages to our society and our economy from methane leaks are substantially higher than the market value to firms.
And methane does leak. Somewhere between 1.4 and 2.3% of all the methane extracted from the ground does go whoosh into the air because companies don't capture it. Hausman crunched the numbers, and she says it's worth 10 times as much to society to fix leaks as it is to a company. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There is all kinds of stuff on this tariff list that kicks in on Sunday. Electrothermic hand drying apparatuses, whatever those are, somebody help me out. Ginger, neither crushed nor ground. Grand pianos. Also,
human hair, dressed, thinned, bleached, or otherwise worked for use in making wigs and the like.
China, it turns out, is one of the world's biggest exporters of human hair. So should you be in need of a wig or extensions, 15% extra come Sunday. Related and also on the list, badger hair used to make brushes. Sure, you could lend the government your money for 30 years. That's the current long bond in the U.S. government's debt offerings. But if that's not enough for you, how do 50 or even 100-year bonds sound? Should that fit your investing needs? Somehow. Good news from the Treasury Department. Secretary Steven Mnuchin said this week the United States is, in fact, considering really long bonds. Other countries and companies have done it. But why the Treasury Department? And why now? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson cracks this one.
Interest rates right now are low, like very low. The yield on the 30-year Treasury bond is around the lowest it's ever been. So Andrew Hollenhorst, chief U.S. economist for Citigroup, says it makes sense for Treasury to see if it could lock in those rates for as long as possible.
The Treasury's mandate, among other things, is to fund the government at the lowest possible cost.
Other countries, including Austria and Argentina, have already issued some ultra-long bonds. But Hollenhorst says the Treasury Department would probably only move forward if it thought it could sell them regularly. And so the big question is who'd buy these bonds and how much demand there'd be for them. Marilyn Cohen, CEO of Envision Capital Management, says these bonds don't make sense for individual investors, but
I think it makes tons of sense for anybody like a pension fund, like an insurance fund, in which they know they have to pay off the obligations that are locked and loaded and due in another 50 years or another 100 years.
The demand question is harder to answer, says Torsten Slok, chief economist at Deutsche Bank.
The risk, of course, is that you as a government go out and issue a lot of 50 or 100-year bonds. And if you issue too much, then there's demand for them. You run the risk that the interest rates will be a lot higher.
Which would pretty much defeat the point. He says uncertainty about demand may be why Treasury hasn't moved forward with this idea when it explored it in the past. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There's a slice of the housing market that's pure logistics, right? You find a house you like. You make an offer, maybe there's a counter, maybe not, but eventually, hopefully, you sign a contract. But then the waiting starts. There's money to move around, inspections and appraisals to be done, a zillion things that can go wrong before you finally get your hands on or get to hand over the keys. Turns out, though, as Marketplace's Ben Bradford reports, that the length of time a home sale is pending has actually been going down.
Jamie Droz knew she wanted her Dallas area home as soon as she walked in the front door.
You walk down a tiny hallway, and then it opens up into the living room, and it just kind of was like this ah feeling.
Droz says from ah to ownership took about 30 pretty smooth days.
Everything was like pre-approved, and then there's like a few final things you have to do right at the end.
A survey this month from LendingTree found the average closing time takes 40 days. That's down from 74 days just a couple years ago. Brandon Sanders and his girlfriend closed on their new home in Columbia, South Carolina yesterday. It took about 6 weeks, and Sanders noticed this.
A lot of the paperwork is done electronically now, so they just email you and you DocuSign stuff.
Yes, mortgage companies have joined the age of the internet, allowing not just e-signatures, but for customers to scan in bank statements and tax returns using their phones. Tendai Kamfitse at LendingTree says digitization in the heavily regulated industry took time.
A lot of these products were under development for probably 6, 7, 8 years. It's just kind of the sweet spot now of everything coming together.
But Steve Patrick at Gateway Mortgage Group says now closing times are lengthening because of low interest rates.
We have the same number of staff to what we had a month ago, but a lot more volume just because everybody's trying to refinance all at the same time.
Patrick says he's heard at some banks it's taking twice as long to approve a mortgage as it took a month ago. I'm Ben Bradford from Marketplace.
Coming up.
I am going to other protein sources.
Wait, is that a bodybuilding story or more tariffs? First, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 326 points today, 1.2%, closed at 26,362, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 116 points, 1.4%, 79.73. The S&P 500 picked up 36 points, 1.2%. 29 and 24. Algos. Say that 10 times fast. Dollar General charged up 10.6% today. The discount chain issued an upbeat full-year forecast. Chip makers with business in China did well. Micron Technologies jumped 3.5% today. Qualcomm quickened 2.8%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.49%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so unrecorded magnetic media, machinery for preparing, tanning, or working hides, skins, or leather, egg albumin other than dried. I could go on. I mean, it is 122 pages.
Fishing casts or leaders, artificial baits and flies, traveling circuses and traveling menageries, parts and accessories thereof. Merry-go-rounds, boat swings, shooting galleries and other fairground amusements, traveling theatres, parts and accessories thereof.
My name is Dennis Spiegel, president of International Theme Park Services, Inc.
The good people at International Theme Park Services, Inc. consult internationally on the leisure industry.
The fair business, the carnival business, the traveling amusement business, permanent facilities of a smaller variety, the mom and pop type of parks, those would all be candidates for this type of equipment.
Mr. Spiegel says, although imports of merry-go-rounds from China are, relatively speaking, small, a tariff is a tariff.
If you're buying a merry-go-round that, say, is $100,000, this increases the price, the base price, to $115,000.
And if you're packing and shipping and installing one of those things, it adds up.
So that additional 15% could be a deal killer.
Should you be curious about the full list of things that are going to be 15% more expensive come Sunday at 12:01 a.m., say you're in the market for ostriches or glass eyes, we've got it at marketplace.org. All right, not that the entire American economy revolves around China, but a chunk of it does. Stuff we import, yes, but also stuff we export, including recyclables, scrap metals specifically. Or I should say, scrap metals that we used to send over there, because a little bit more than a year ago, Beijing stopped taking most U.S. recyclables, which was very bad news for Randy Goodman. He's an executive vice president at Greenland America. They're out of Roswell, Georgia. They sell those recyclable scrap metals overseas. We had him on the program at the time. We got him back on the phone today. Randy, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me back, Kai.
So we had you on last May of 2018. The trade war was in its early stages. The Chinese had just sort of launched an environmental crackdown, which was affecting the scrap and recycling business. And we had a chat about how business was back then. How you doing now, August of 2019?
Well, it's been a roller coaster for the past year and a half between the environmental issues with China and how they block things down and the trade war. It's made for interesting business times in the scrap, over all aspects of scrap, metal, plastic, glass, paper, all of it.
How's the trade war hitting you, though, sir? That's the question.
Over the last couple of months, it's gotten pretty bad in certain situations. Because if they're not buying, then they're either sucking other materials in to replace it, or there's excess surplus of materials around the world because China's simply not been in the markets for a lot of them, and they have not found all the homes that they want to.
Well, so talk to me about that surplus, right? Because when you got more of something, the price usually goes down. How are you getting hit by that?
It has gone down precipitously over the last year in multiple commodities. And that all leads to or comes back to the issue that China's not buying those materials and most likely will not ever, even if the trade wars settled. China's made a drastic change in how they're viewing scrap, and they're eliminating the parts of it that can get them into environmental troubles and only importing what seems to be furnace-ready material for manufacturing.
Huh. So when you go looking for new customers, I guess is what you say, right? New destinations for the scrap that you get, where do you look?
First of all, you do see some of the people that were in China starting to relocate their businesses in other parts of the world. Example, Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia. That being said, it's still not a replacement for those tonnages. Over the last year and a half, we've been lucky enough to have India with an appetite, but they have a limit to what they can consume also. And with no new facilities being built to smelt copper or smelt aluminum, there seems to be more supply than demand in a lot of categories right now.
That would seem to be a business model problem for you. What are you going to do?
I think that we're continuing to look as an industry at where people are building new infrastructure around the world and where they might be interested in consuming that material. And you just have to put your ear to the ground and take some plane rides.
Without wanting to prejudge in any way, what's your level of recession worry? Is there a thing you're looking at?
A couple of things. I mean, there's been several articles in our trade magazines that reference Dr. Copper.
I'm sorry, Dr. Copper?
Dr. Copper.
Okay.
Meaning that copper can kind of diagnose where we are going as an economy. And if you read those, they kind of tell you that and copper's going down precipitously as it has over the last couple of months. It's a very fine indicator that not that you're coming into a recession, but you're already there.
Oh, man. Well, that's distressing.
Well, others would tell you that we're not, but whether we are or not, the scrap industry from all sides has been suffering for the last year or so. It's going to be an interesting ride for the next several.
Randy Goodman is an executive vice president at Greenland America. They do scrap recycling, sometimes to China, sometimes not, as it turns out. Mr. Goodman, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Kai, it's been a pleasure to talk to you again.
We've got some listeners we check in with every now and then to talk about inflation in this economy. Inflation is generally subdued right now in the aggregate, but when you're out there doing your shopping, you care about what's right in front of you, right?
Hey, Marketplace. This is Michael Devitt from Boise, Idaho. You know, I haven't really noticed a lot of inflation in things that we buy on a day-to-day basis. However, we have noticed over the past couple months a fairly significant increase in prices in the restaurants that we go to. It seems this summer they all printed new menus, and on all of the new menus, all the prices had gone up fairly significantly.
This is Ernesto in Chicago. I've been flying back and forth to Puerto Rico from Chicago for 30 years on and off. For the first time this year, a flight cost me over $700 three, 4 months in advance. And this is the most outrageously expensive trip. I even fudge with the dates, going leaving a day earlier, leaving a day late. Even then, there wasn't that much of a difference. So I don't know. They're just out for my money.
Hello, Marketplace. This is Ellen Murphy from Mission Hills, Kansas. Fish is probably the one thing taking kind of a hit from me, and I am going to other protein sources. Another thing that's expensive was fresh garlic. And I found out that it was $5 a pound because it was from China. And we're told that they got rid of the Chinese sourced garlic and they are back in California garlic again. So it's back to $2.99 a pound.
That Chinese garlic that Ellen was talking about, by the way, the $5 a pound stuff, got hit with a 25% tariff earlier this year. Yo, You want to talk tariffs on Chinese imports, and of course we do because we are. You got to talk textiles. China is a huge source for American textile makers and retailers.
Men's or boys' overcoats, car coats, capes, cloaks, anoraks, windbreakers, and similar articles, knitted or crocheted, of cotton. Men's or boys' overcoats, car coats, capes, cloaks, windbreakers, and similar articles, knitted or crocheted, of man-made fibers, Nsui.
One of the major products on the tariff list that goes into effect on September 1st are coats, and we're looking at cotton coats, man-made fiber coats, raincoats, any type of outerwear that you're buying for kids for back to school.
Julie Hughes is the president of the U.S. Fashion Industry Association. In just the last 12 months, Julie said, Americans imported more than 300 million coats from China.
So, you know, if you look at your ski jacket or your rain jacket, there's a lot of features, right? There might be pocketing, there might be special treatments, there might be linings. And most of that production ended up focusing on China because they had the fabric availability and they had the skilled workers in the factories making those garments.
Important to note here that imports of textiles from China have been tariffed for a long, long time already.
For some of these products, like a rain slicker, you might have a tariff as high as 32% in the tariff schedule. So you're adding 15% duties on top of that. That's a big hit. But, you know, prices are going up. I think that's the thing for consumers to watch out for.
You want a good story of American outerwear retailers dealing with existing Chinese tariffs? If I could do a little shameless self-promotion here, go to marketplace.org, search on Columbia Sportswear. Trust me, it's totally fascinating. All right, this final note on the way out today, I am actually just going to read a couple more line items from the tariff schedule that goes into effect on Sunday, because honestly, it is kind of an amazing snapshot of how varied this economy really is. Remember, everything gets 15% more expensive this weekend, so here you go. It's just a couple. Prepared explosives other than propellant powders. Prune juice, concentrated or not concentrated. Bees, live insects other than bees. Pen nibs and nib points. Refill cartridges for pens other than ballpoint pens. I'm telling you, fascinating. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 326 points today, 1.2%. The NASDAQ up 116, 1.4%. S&P 500 picked up 36 points, 1.2% there. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, who was, by the way, John was the voice of the harmonized tariff schedule today. Got to give him a shout out there. Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bikella, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.